Hi, hello, podcast consumer, prosumer podcast. Here it is. I feel a migraine creeping in right now, and so I'm mixing my words. Let's get through this before the blinding pain sets in for us all. Today on the podcast, we have Nick Diamonds, or Nick Thorburn, you pick. The line seems to be a bit blurry depending on his feelings, maybe. I don't know. I couldn't quite get to the bottom of it. Nick Diamonds from Islands, Reefer, Human Highway, the Serial podcast soundtrack, other things that I can't think through the migraine to get to. We talked about stuff. I'm a really big fan, and there were moments that I was like, hey, I'm a big fan, and maybe we're not a little bit about that, which is probably going to be a little bit cringy with hindsight, but it felt organic at the time, and I felt like I needed to tell him. It felt nice to be able to tell someone that, so that's what you get to be privy to as you listen to this, and you say to yourself, that guy Stran needs to work on being cool and being a bit more of a pro, because that was a bit gushy. How embarrassing. But hey, here it is. Here it is for you all. I usually say a little bit more at the beginning, but today I'm in too much pain. So, let's do it. I love you.
How you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Sweet. Been having a good day?
Yeah, pretty good day. I did yoga this morning, and now I'm just kind of sort of hung over, so I'm just kind of chilling.
Yeah, sweet. Yeah. Cool, man. Thank you so much for doing this, Nick.
Yeah, I thought your unpacking video was really funny, and I'm down for the cause.
Choice. Thanks very much. I try to make them as terrible as possible, but also as quick as possible.
Yeah, it was very entertaining.
So how was tour?
It was cool. Yeah, it was good. I would say it was a positive experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not always, you know.
Yeah, sure. I remember I think in an old interview with you, you were talking about like old unicorns tours and just like traveling through Canada in winter in like a freezing cold van with I think a hole in the bottom or something.
Yes, that was a motorhome that we bought. My dad helped us, my Alden and I, buy it, and it was like $1,500 for this raggedy 1971 motorhome, and the floor was falling out and the muffler fell off, and it was a disaster. It was a total disaster, and there was no heat, and we had to sleep in there because we were opening for Hot Out Heat, and they paid us $100 a night, so we had to sleep in this van. It was in the dead of winter across Canada. That's, you know, that's what paying your dues is all about. You got to start there. I mean, maybe not that extreme, but you have to rough it for a bit, I think, to really get perspective, you know?
Yeah, I've had mates who have gone over to the US and done like a coast-to-coast sort of tours, and they just turn up at one end of the US, buy the cheapest car they can find, just run it over the country, and then just ditch it somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. We did that on our very first tour. Yeah, just bought a car for $200, got it across the country, and then it just died actually pulling into my parents' place. So yeah,
nick of time.
Yeah.
So how have things changed? What's the arrangement been this time
Of tour?
Yeah,
I just think we're all the band, we all, there's four of us, and we just all really kind of connect on a musical level and on a personal level. I think we enjoy each other. We're all very different, but there's a common ground that we can find, especially through the music and performing. And that's not always the case. You know, sometimes there can be resistance and just like contrasting, you know, moods or styles that don't really, you know, that it doesn't necessarily cohese or whatever. So
yeah,
we're kind of, it's very simpatico, I think.
Right.
And that helps. That helps. And the records, people seem to really like them. So it helps to play a lot of new material and have it feel good. Because it always feels good to do an older catalog song because it's lived with people for years. And so it's like an easy trick to pull out of your sleeve.
Do you still enjoy those old ones?
I do, yeah. And if I don't, we'll ditch them for a while. And we ditched Rough Gem for...
Oh, yeah.
Like 8 years, I think. And this time around, I was like, it's been 10 years since that first record came out. And people always love that song and request it. I personally don't relate to it or like it that much anymore. I need to figure out a way to play it that makes it enjoyable for me. And the way to do it was really just to strip down the kind of all the like ornate instrumentation and like kind of scrunky synth stuff and just more of a rock, like just strip it to its like bare elements and similar to what it was like back when the Unicorns played it. Cause it was originally a Unicorn song. It was going to be on the next record, but unfortunately our last tour in Australia was the last time we had any desire to play together. So
yeah. So how do you like with my experience with going on tour, it seems that there's a lot of sort of empty time that you're kind of just hanging out and waiting for the next bit to happen, especially like traveling from place to place. Do you manage to use that productively?
I always have the aspiration to use it so productively.
Yeah.
And I do for a short while. In the beginning, I'll be reading and I'll be writing and swimming at the hotel pools in the morning or skipping rope. And then, you know, after the first week, that all goes out the window and it's just total vegetation and mindlessness.
Yeah.
It's just the monotony of tour. It's hard to fight. It's a real struggle. And doing those drives, it's a killer. Yeah. Just sitting all day and waiting and you get an hour and a half of joy. And I've been in a lot of like chronic pain. I have tendonitis and it's gotten really, really bad in my left hand. So all day I'm feeling this pain. And then, you know, there's something called stage health. You get up on stage, your pain just goes away. Adrenaline kicks in. And so that
man.
Hour.
Is that you?
I've had it in varying degrees intermittently since 2008.
Right.
But it's sort of gotten worse the past year. Now I'm trying, that's why I was doing yoga this morning. I'm trying to combat it and stay on top of it, which I'm slowly doing, I think. But but that hour and a half on stage is all the pain melts away and it's it's obviously the thing I look forward to in the day, most every day when I'm on tour. So.
And you were touring with Honus Honus.
On the West Coast, we were, yeah.
Yeah. How is that? I'm pretty sure at least on his set list, I saw a Mr. Heavenly song or two.
Yes, we did. And I came up and did that. I'm a Hologram with him.
Right,
that's the one. Yeah, it was kind of cool. He's acknowledging his catalog and stuff and dropping that in. I mean, his show's awesome though. It's really,
I'll bet
his band is
such a showman.
Yeah, he's a lunatic.
Yeah.
He's like a Dr. John level maniac or something.
Yeah, yeah. And I saw that you're also doing Where There's a Will, There's a Whalebone.
Yes.
As well. Do you still get who's Bus Driver and who's the other?
Subtitle.
That's
and
the
now
one.
Now he goes by Giovanni Marx. They came out in LA, which was always, it feels so magical to have them both. It feels like it's very special for me to have when that goes down. So.
Yeah, that's very cool. Cause that's been what, like 10 years. I guess
10 years. Yeah, we've been doing that when available, we've gotten together. So it's a really nice reunion to be up there on stage. And,
That's real cool. I don't know much about your The Corn Gang days, but that's about the only sort of direct crossover into the Islands catalog, huh?
Yeah, so that was kind of the palate cleanse between the Unicorns and Islands. Jamie and I came from the Unicorns, came down to LA after the band broke up. And we're just kind of regrouping and assessing the situation. And, you know, we decided we wanted to keep playing music together and we wanted to do this band. And we were also really into rap music and production and wanting to do, make beats. And something we decided to do while we were in LA was to put a band together, like a group together. That was Bus Driver and Subtitle and this other guy named Vic. So that was kind of the transitional out of the Unicorns and into Islands. It was just like, yeah, it was like an appetizer.
Yeah. Did you have aspirations to go longer or like release anything? Cause nothing got recorded with that, right?
No, I know. We talked about it. We wanted to, we moved back to Montreal after 3 months in LA. And we just started focusing on making the Islands record.
Right.
We didn't, it just kind of got left. It just got left behind, but yeah, there was always talk to do something. Mm-hmm. We had a couple like actual tunes that we played, and we would like chop and screw old like Unicorn songs. We were really just like trying to, you know, almost be a remix, like a humanoid remix of a band, and just like, okay, we're remixing the Unicorns, and now we're the Corn Gang. Right. We play these songs like Tough Ghost and Ready to Die, but we slow them down, or we put like a, you know, hip hop beat behind it. And
yeah,
then
the whole Unicorns thing has been so like mythologized, and because it was sort of like there was a breakup because of creative differences or whatever, and I've seen like on so many different fan sites just or forums or whatever of kind of almost Oasis level like speculation of this sort of, I don't know, competitive tension or whatever.
It's, right.
It feels very bizarre. But I imagine it gets pretty tiresome to talk about for you.
It comes in waves. I honor that part of my life and appreciate it and acknowledge its worth. I don't want to spend too much time in my life reflecting. I feel like I've got so much more to offer, and I feel like I've gotten better at offering.
Definitely. That's one of the reasons I get so weirded out by people kind of when they go back and talk about the Unicorns. To me, it's just like, but there's all this other stuff happening.
Yeah, but it's nostalgic, and like it's a certain mode that we accessed, and what was so nice is that we were pretty naive and young, and nothing was calculated really. We were just kind of trying to be punks and like shake it up a little bit, and you know, it's kind of a perfect name for what it became, which like you said, it's been this mythologized like mythical thing that doesn't exist anymore, but it kind of is a pretty tidy, like it's good for it to stay extinct because it serves the mythology, I think, you know.
Right. So I kind of like, I definitely didn't want to talk about Unicorns that much because there's lots of other interesting stuff that you're doing that I want to talk about. But while we're on the subject, I did sort of just want to talk about like the reunion. Was it last year? Year before.
It was 2 years ago now.
Yeah.
Surprisingly.
Because I remember you had talked about previously how that sort of was cut short, and that sort of indirectly or maybe even directly led to your City of Courts solo album.
Yes, that's correct.
From the cut momentum, I guess.
Yeah, you've done your research. That's correct. That is exactly, yeah, pretty much how it went down. I had this motivation and this inspiration, and I needed to channel it somewhere. So I just did it myself, you know.
Yeah, were any of the ideas or songs in City of Courts, were they possibly like in embryonic stages of being new unicorn songs?
Just one, Something About the Moon. That's what one of the songs that I wanted to bring to the table as a potential new song.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it kind of has a feel, I guess, of a unicorn song. Maybe.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that was a disappointment. That whole experience from soup to nuts was a bummer. Mm. And I regret it. I regret doing it, but that's in the past.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I'm pretty fascinated by, like, if this comes across as like trying to dig dirt or anything, like, I'm pretty happy to move on. But
I'm
pretty fascinated by the whole, like, I've been in several bands, and just the idea of when things don't work because of creative differences, like, what does that actually look like on the ground? Like, where are the clues, like in band rehearsals or whatever, where you start going, oh shit, maybe this guy's not into what I'm into? Or what did that look like at that point?
Musically, it was always pretty, we were pretty much always on the same page. I think as soon as we got down to business,
yeah,
and started playing, there was you know, we were in sync.
Yeah.
But everything else, absolutely everything else, was conflict. And the shows were, you know, we were told whatever. I don't need to go into it, but it was not the way it was presented. It was not the way it was that it was proposed to us was not the way it was presented. The shows that we did opening for our friends.
Right.
So the shows were extremely disappointing. Like the setup, the way we were treated, basically. It was not a pleasant experience for us, or I think people that maybe drove 20 hours from Florida up to New York to see us. And I think it was a bad look for us. But you know, that's life.
And, yeah, yeah.
And it's sort of too bad that we did this like impossible thing, Lazarus rising from the dead, and it was a little underwhelming. It wasn't how I would have liked it to go. So that's how it goes. You don't always get to control that. And yeah. I'm glad that I could pivot back into Islands and solo stuff and all the other things I want to do. So
yeah, yeah.
It wasn't too big of a loss. You know, it was easy to just return to my regular,
yeah,
scheduled
sure. It's not
program.
Like it's not as if you were left wanting for like, what do I do now?
Yeah, yeah. I have plenty more things to fill my plate. So it was pretty easy to just let it go.
Yeah. You know? Cool. All right. Well, let's talk about those. I want to talk about your new records.
Cool.
I'm like a real slow listener, so I'm still digesting them. Like there's even like, I can't even, it takes me ages to sort of differentiate between the different tracks on an album.
Yes.
But I'll try to talk about the albums cause I bloody love them. I was just thinking about like playing them live. I imagine that the Should I Remain Here at Sea songs like have translated real easily. But with Taste, since that was a bit more less live recording,
yeah,
like did that take quite a bit of work, like workshopping them into a live environment?
It took a lot of work, and almost all of that work fell on Evan's plate, and he did an insanely good job. He, I don't even understand what he did. He did basically the equivalent, like we wanted to do these songs with sequencing and programming and arpeggiated stuff that was synced without having to have backing tracks, without playing to tracks, which we'd actually done on the Vapors tour, the first tour we did. And it was miserable. It's not fun to play to a majority of big bands do it, and I think it's dreadful. Like to want to play to a click, there's just no movement, there's no feel, there's no groove. So, or you know, a click is fine, but like playing to tracks that are queuing up, it just sounds shitty and it doesn't feel good. It just feels kind of canned.
Totally.
And so Evan did this brilliant thing where we had this sample, the drum trigger and sample pad that Adam was triggering that was hooked up to a clock, which was going to his synths. It was this very complicated process, and I don't even understand how Evan did it, but he's a genius. And it basically, probably what we did was more in line with what like Depeche Mode was doing in the 80s versus maybe what they're doing now or what a lot of bands do now, which is just have a computer, like a laptop that triggers stuff, that plays back tracks and stuff. This was all done kind of analog. So it was really awesome. And it really, like, I think we kind of knocked it out of the park as far as getting it to sound natural and live and real, but also full and, you know, honoring all the arrangements and the
parts.
Yeah.
I've heard, obviously I couldn't make it to any from New Zealand, but I heard the, someone chucked up a recording of the, was it the Chicago show that was streamed or something?
Yes, the Chicago show is streamed.
Yeah, someone's chucked up and like uploaded the that show.
Which is cool. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So
they kind of ripped it and.
Yeah, like I don't know how they did it, but it sounds good. Like it's good. good quality. They chucked it up on Reddit. So.
Oh, nice.
I swiped that.
Great.
And what I heard sounded great and true to the records and
yeah. Thanks.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I really like, I bloody love Taste. And to me, Taste is still like a real treat when I listen to it because the download code didn't work. So I'm only listening to it on vinyl. So only when I kind of like have the time to like set it down and like really get into it. So I haven't heard it much, but every time I hear it, it's like, oh man.
Oh, thanks. Why didn't the download code work?
I don't know.
did you get the record before May 13th?
I got it. Like I've tried it a couple of times since, but like I got, you know, the pre-order. Well, obviously, because I
wonder if right, exactly. I wonder if you tried the code before, because I think if you tried the code before the actual album was officially released, I don't think those links were live until after May 13th.
Okay,
and then if you already tried it, it would like not work. It's really dumb. I need to fix that. But I can send you the MP3s. That's not fair. You paid for them.
Yeah, man. That'd be sweet to work that out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, like that wasn't meant to be much of a complaint, but more like it has always felt real nice because I'm not listening to it on my laptop speakers or my car speakers. I'm listening to it with my nice speakers that are hooked up to my record player. And the synth sounds like everything. Like Evan. I'm assuming that a lot of that's Evan. And it just sounds so beautiful. And what I really love about it is that it's such like a synthy album, but it's not 80s nostalgia.
Yeah.
It sounds current. It sounds, I guess, innovative and fresh.
Thanks.
I've heard like other people, when other people have talked about using certain types of instruments or certain software even, it feels like it's driving them in a certain direction. Was there any point that you were kind of doing the synth thing and going, oh shit, we sound like we're trying to be the 80s and having to like move away from it?
No, because I don't know how to be genre specific. I don't think, like, not to say that I'm above any kind of the trappings of specific genres, but I just feel like everything is we're at a point where everyone is, I think, a lot of people now with records, like you just pull from different eras and different influences and different styles, and it becomes this sort of hodgepodge sound. And, you know, it's just, it's alchemical. Anytime I'm going to be adding this element and Evan's synths are going to be like this, or, you know, it's like there's going to be, it's just naturally not going to sound like one thing. I think you have to make a real effort And say, like, we want to make it sound just like this Heaven 17 record or whatever.
Sure.
And that's never been our goal. Like, maybe there'll be elements of a thing where it's like, oh, yeah, that sort of harkens back to Heart of Glass by Blondie. But it's it's just one element in a whole, you know, component.
So. Gotcha. With those two records... For an obsessive, like, cataloger of records such as myself, what one should go first on the shelf? Taste or Should I Remain Here at Sea?
The way I envision it is that Taste came out before. Like, it's considered LP6, and then Should I Remain Here at Sea is LP7. It's the one that... It's kind of the... You know, Taste is what you... Is, like, the entree, and then... Should I Remain Here at Sea is just sort of the, it's like the bill has arrived. Now you got to pay for it.
Yeah.
yeah. And it's kind of the come down, you know, that's how it feels to me.
I hear you. That makes sense.
And it feels like more of a tidy circle to have it the current catalog begins with Return to the Sea and ends with a kind of response to that.
Yeah. I wanted to talk to you about that. Like, you, not all the time, but semi-frequently, like, there's spatterings of self-referencing and that kind of thing in your work. How much of, like, do you kind of go out of your way to be like, oh, this will be cool, like, fans will enjoy, like, if I kind of write this little bit of a line, or...
It kind of just happens. I mean, there's certain touchstones I just return to, but it also is nice to kind of have that conversation with the songs and have them kind of communicate, because they are part of they're part of a bigger galaxy of songs, so it's nice that they can interact and have a relationship with one another. And, you know, that was like with the first Islands, you know, Swans, Life After Death was like a direct response to Ready to Die, which was both are Notorious B.I.G. albums, so it was kind of like just sort of trying to thread, you know, to thread a larger narrative throughout the songs, I guess. That there's one narrator the whole time. Even if the stories are different, there's still like a singular voice that can reference the universe of these songs, I guess.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about, like, your stage name. I think I remember you talking about at one point, like, kind of shirking the stage name and kind of feeling a little bit embarrassed that you had one and then sort of coming back to it, but I might have misunderstood. Do you remember why you went with a stage name in the first place?
I think I just thought my name sounded too... It didn't have, like, a good rock. Nick Thorburn just, to me, didn't sound like Iggy Pop or...
Right.
You know, Lou Reed or... You know, it just didn't have that kind of punch to it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it seemed like kind of a fun thing to just like go full into making a character. And I was definitely more into the character side of things back in the day.
Yeah.
And kind of preserving my own identity and sort of putting forth this personality that I could kind of come in and out of. And so it was easier to name it and, have an alternate identity, like, it's just something nice to be able to turn off and turn on.
And then I
just couldn't commit to it. By the second Islands record, I kind of wanted to get real and like kind of come out, take the mask off and step out behind the curtain or whatever.
Yeah.
And then now I sort of use it as like, I can kind of slip in and out, you like for solo record purposes, I guess, is how I do it. It's but, you know, as far as Islands, it's kind of always gonna be, I think. I don't know. It's hard to say. It's a messy brand. My brand is it's messy.
Yeah, because I was thinking like, if you have some sort of like, even if inconsistent, like weird set of criteria, like, oh, this, you know, I'll do the serial soundtrack is Nick Thorburn, and then like this other thing is Nick Diamonds.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
I'm not making it easy for myself for, you know, coalescing a fan base. I make it difficult, but
we got to work for it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And with the band name Islands, what was the origin of that? Did that come from? Oh, I can't even remember what the song is on the first album. There's one of the songs refers to islands, but I don't know. Was it
on Ready to Die on the Unicorns?
Oh, it might have been that actually.
There is a line. I woke up thirsty on an island.
Yeah.
In the sea, at the sea, or yeah, on an island in the sea. I don't know. Yeah. It's kind of a reference to that, and to me, an island is such a great. It's a pretty blank canvas that you can put a lot of meaning into, and specifically for me, at the time, it was this nice evocative. I was trying to think of like what would Brian Eno call what would he call a band name, and it like had this, you know, it has this feeling. Maybe when you first hear it, you think, oh, tropical, warm, sunny. But then if you think of an island on another level, like Simon and Garfunkel, I'm an island, I'm a rock.
Mm.
It's an isolation. It's like it's a lonely, cold place. And so to contrast those two, which I think is what I always tried to do with the music, where maybe the chords and melody were like sunny and pop infused, but the lyrics were dark and dreary.
Yeah.
Like it was that kind of dichotomy that I wanted the name to exist in. And it's a little too general, I think. You know, it's hard to Google, and
yeah.
But I still think it works as a band name, especially for the thing.
Yeah, I like it. Like, I guess band names have been on my mind a bit. I've just like, I've started a new band lately, like with my wife, and we've had like a lot of heaps of arguments about like band names before finally settling on one. And like, so many times just like, no, that's terrible. No, that's terrible. No, that's terrible. And that whole like, yeah, thinking it's got to be Googleable. When you say it to someone, they can't be like, what? What did you say? And
yeah,
all that kind of thing. And you don't want to be too specific. Like car seat headrests, I think, is like maybe not the best band name that I've heard.
Right.
And, yeah, not too vague either, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a tricky one.
You've had a lot of practice at it, though. You've had a lot of bands.
I have, yeah. I think the reference is the coolest thing. Like, if you can reference a line in a movie or a song or something, it just like the homage. It's kind of a good move, I think.
Yeah. Speaking of all your bands and things, like I was trying to make heads and tails of your career, and I actually just before this interview, like, wrote out a little timeline for myself, and it turns out that most of the confusion is just that you did 3 albums in 2008, which is a lot.
That's true. Yeah, that is true. One was like an EP, but
Reefer.
Yes, Reefer.
That was one that I barely knew about, despite like following your music for a long time. Yeah, it's a little bit different to your other stuff.
It is. Yeah, it was a. Yeah, I don't know what was going on there, but it was just, yeah, it was it happened.
Sure.
I don't really remember it. Went to Hawaii and made that record, so
that's pretty cool. That's a story. It's not everyone goes to Hawaii to make a record.
No. Yeah, it was pretty great. It was a really great experience, and getting what we did was the producer, his name is Daddy Kev, he's kind of big in the LA like rap and electronic underground, like that Flying Lotus kind of world. He was like, you know, flew me and my lady out to Hawaii, and during the day we got to do kind of sightseeing stuff, and then at night we would just kind of improvise this record, and that's what we did for a week. Yeah, so it was a real easy, relaxing, you know, it was like it was being on holiday basically.
Yeah, I can see how it would be easy to forget, like, because you've got all the stuff going on.
Yeah, so it just kind of, it was a very easy breezy thing that just sort of happened, and now it's just a faded memory. I don't really even know. I haven't heard that record in a while.
Also, like, yeah, with Human Highway, another sort of one-off album with Jim Guthrie. I've seen every now and then, like, I'll see comments on your thing, on like things that you put out, of people being like, when's another Human Highway happening? Do you still plan to maybe do another one of those?
Yeah, I want to, and Jim wants to, I think, too. It's just about, like,
syncing up,
and he's in Toronto, and he's really busy doing a lot of soundtrack stuff.
Oh, okay.
And, he's doing, like, really well in that world, so, like, video game soundtrack specifically.
Oh, choice.
So it's a matter of when we can kind of get together and when the time is right. It would be kind of nice. I wanted to sync it up for 2018 because that'll be 10 years after the
true.
Man, the first record.
It's crazy.
I know. It's messed up.
He was pretty involved with, was it with the First Islands album?
He did. He played on Swans and he toured. He was in the touring the first iteration of the band for the first few months.
Right.
Actually, from November till April, I think, of 2006, he was in the band. He did probably three tours with us. So.
Right, on guitar or?
Yeah, he was on guitar. Yeah, we had three guitars. It was the last dying days of indie rock excess. We were like an 8-piece band or something stupid.
Yeah, well, the first album or two like really need that. Like, there's such complex arrangements.
Yeah.
I was thinking about it recently about how some of them, especially like Vertigo or Swans, Humans, like that, they feel so meticulously like composed. Were they like is it more you like sitting down like almost with sheet music or whatever and like planning it out, or how much of that is that versus like just jamming it out in a band scenario and working out the practices?
I was very meticulous on my part. Swans, you know, which actually references the first Unicorns song actually, but it was a very methodical process, especially with that song. I remember the first day I started to write Swans, I sat on my couch for 12 hours just working it out from morning, noon, and night, just trying to find it and you know, because there's like different sections and it's very elaborate. So
yeah,
and I think Vertigo is similarly at 13 minutes.
Both beautiful songs.
Thanks.
I've listened to those two so many times.
Oh, cool.
Vertigo, yeah. I think Vertigo, the whole Arms Way album for me was really formative, actually, just in my own musical making career. Like, when I was first getting into writing music and stuff, I discovered Arms Way and listened to it on repeat a lot. But
sweet.
Vertigo, just the way it goes through those different sections, I'm still making sense of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a song I don't even know. I don't think I'd be able to play that now. I have no idea what the hell I was doing.
Yeah, because I wonder that about that sometimes, like with songs with so many different sections. If at some point you're like, oh, should these be two separate songs? Like,
right.
Or should I tie them together?
Right.
Does that ever happen?
Yeah, I think so. I think it does, and sometimes they become separate. Songs, and then sometimes it makes more sense to combine them, and there's definitely been, I think, in the past, I kind of black out when I write, so I don't really have a recollection of anything during the process, but I think there's been times when I've had two separate songs and it suddenly makes sense to kind of fuse them together, not in a forced way, but
it just sort of makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, a song like Swans is literally referencing an older song. So I did, like, kind of stitch the beginning and end of that song to this new song, grafted these parts onto it, bookended them. Very intentionally, because it was all a reference. The song was all, like, a giant reference to the transition from that band to Islands. But, Vertigo, I don't know what the hell I was. I don't think I was stitching songs together. I think I was just trying to take it as far as I could go, take a song as make it as elaborate and.
Which you don't like If you are writing like overly complex things, you'd definitely be more subtle about it. Do you feel like there was like you've refined the style, or do you feel like back then you were sort of striving for something that you're not as interested in now?
I think I was trying to prove. I think Arm's Way was coming off of the Unicorns and the First Islands record, where I was getting my music was being called whimsical and cute a lot, and it irked me. I felt like there was a lot more depth to the songs than what people were seeing on the surface. So Arm's Way was me like, okay, I'm grown up now. Like, I'm not gonna. I want to really prove to you that I'm serious and that I'm mature, which is, you know, sometimes it can be a misstep, just trying too hard to prove something can backfire. But
do you feel good about what you proved with that album?
I don't know. I haven't listened to it in a long time. I think it's this. I have definite problems with it. Musically, I think it's interesting. I think I could have relaxed a little bit on a lot of it, but I have problems with it, but I feel so separate from it now that I don't even, it feels like a different person made that record.
Yeah. But. Right. To me, it seems almost like concept album-ish a little bit,
mm-hmm.
which I think a few of your albums have to me, like Return to the Sea definitely seems like pretty concept album-y, like it seems to be all about some kind of apocalypse. And other ones almost seem more concept, like just in the way, like musically, like Vapors, it feels like you're like, I'm going to do this sound and make a whole album out of it. Do you kind of do that deliberately? Do you have an idea of this is the kind of album I'm doing, or does it happen more organically?
It always starts organically, but at some point I'd start to shape it into a concept, more of a concept, like Taste being a certain way. Like I had X amount of songs, and it became clear at some point that there was two kind of natural columns that each set could fit into. So, at a certain point, it'll get to a certain point where it's like, these are going to be the more like Vapors style, like Taste is going to be more like in this vein, and Should I Remain Here at Sea is going to be more in this vein. And having a through line for these records that makes it feel intentional, makes it feel like an album other than just like a really random assortment of songs. I think that's important for me, making it, for it to make sense, to make it feel purposeful and intentional and meaningful, to have it be one piece, you know.
I think that makes sense. And like, especially like, I feel like Asleep in a Forgetting maybe has that, I guess, because it had such a strong story, like the whole, you know, breaking up and then going to your friend's house and just like playing the piano for like all summer or something, and just like coming up with these songs, which was great to latch onto as a fan, even though it sounded like a pretty shitty time for you.
Yeah, it was cathartic though.
I remember like I was on tour in Australia when that was released, and I remember in the morning when it came out, I was in some cheap motel with really bad Wi-Fi, and I downloaded the album, which took forever, and made my band late for, I think, I'm pretty sure we missed breakfast, but I was like, I gotta get this album. And then we got in the van, and I was listening to it, and like, when I Can't Feel My Face came on, and I was also a newlywed at the time, and like, then there's these songs, these lines like, I miss my wife, I miss my bed, and I was like, oh man.
could relate.
It really spoke to me. Like, it sounded like almost the opposite to what you were actually writing about, but to me it was just like the whole album had this very strong sort of sense of longing that I really hung on to.
That's nice, thanks.
Yeah, it was
that's Yeah, that means a lot. That's good to hear.
To segue from there, like the other album that I got really into at that time, like on that tour with all that time in a van going through Australian Outback, was Rabbit Habits by Nan Man.
Oh, yeah.
And I was wondering how you got started with Honus Honus.
I think I met him. He came out to an Island show in Philadelphia where he was living.
Right.
And yeah, he just came out, was like real sweet and friendly, and we just kind of stayed in touch, and I went down to Austin for South by Southwest, and we spent a lot of time together and went to each other's shows, and we're just like became fast friends.
Yeah.
And I think he'd mentioned like, oh, we should play music together, we should do something, and I didn't really take it seriously, but he sort of kept on it. And you know, 4 years later, it was like, okay, we're actually going to do this. Like, let's actually get together. And he would drive in from Philly up to New York, and where I was living at the time. And we would just, write and work on this record. So it was, yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, the Mr. Heavenly album is very, like, you guys both have styles quite different to each other. And it's amazing to me that you guys did an album together and that it doesn't actually sound like either of your styles. You kind of, that whole doom wop thing, it is as though uh-huh. you wrote yourselves a brief and were like, uh-huh. let's commit to doing this other thing, which doesn't sound like something either of us have done before.
Right. Yeah. I think that was the idea was, you know, we're going to do something different. Let's try to do something different. And, yeah. And it was actually not that hard. And it's also such a pleasure to get outside of your full-time job, so to speak. Like getting out of Islands was,
yeah.
for that time, was it was really nice to try something different
and
flex something different. That was just a good exercise in you know, trying different things.
And
as a result, you know, I think it kind of ends up sounding different, and yeah, we're both so different too, but there's some kind of something that came together, I think, you know, the voices being so contrast.
Was it kind of more like you guys were co-writing songs together, or did you guys more sort of bring songs to each other and then collaborate in the final touches of the songs?
We did both. So some of it was there was a few songs that we brought wholesale into the fold. And then probably the majority, though, we you know, like I have, and we've done this, we've written more since that we're trying to get back together and make another record. But
awesome.
I'll have a guitar part or a chorus, or Ryan will have a verse or a chorus, and we'll just kind of, try to make them work, build off of them and add to it, or just sit and write, you know, just actually sit down, which is pretty hard.
Yeah.
It's not what I'm used to, but it's a good exercise, I think.
Yeah. And how involved is Joe Plummer with all that?
He was involved. I mean, we did the initial writing with just Ryan and I, but definitely his involvement took the songs to a much greater place. And definitely a huge equal member of the band, 100%.
You seem to find very interesting, exciting drummers. Like, even though you've had a few lineup changes in Islands, I don't know how many drummers you've had. Two, three?
Too many.
But
four.
There's always, like, the drumming's always more interesting than the song needs. Like, it adds instead of just supports. How much of that is just finding the right drummer versus, like, do you play drums? Do you write drum parts particularly?
I don't. I mean, I'll write drum machine parts.
Yeah.
And if I demo the song, sometimes it has a basic rhythm. Like, but a lot of the times, you know, I like to leave it to someone who's, the drumming is what they do. And
sure.
I've been fortunate enough that every drummer I've worked with is, like, extremely capable at drumming. There's, you know, I love a primitive drummer. I love, like, the Mo Tucker style. I think it's great. And that's kind of how the Unicorn started, with Alden and I, when we were just a duo, me drumming or he drumming. And there's something to that. But with Islands, yeah, I like being able to turn the song over to the drummer and having them, yeah, just take it up a notch.
You know? Sure. Some songs that you've done have some real cool and bizarre, like spoken word bits, usually just in the intro. And I wanted to ask you about those because I always wonder about them when I hear them. The Human Highways Sleepwalking.
Yeah.
Get away from that window. No one goes out there.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
What's that?
That is a really amazing guy by the name of Dion McGregor, who is asleep. He was a somnambulist. So what that means is that he was an avid sleep talker, but to such a degree that it was as though he was awake. So there's albums. His roommate ended up recording him. He was so fascinated by how involved his dreams were in his sleep talking. So he set up a mic and recorded. So there's albums. There's about three or four different albums of that you can find online.
That is incredible.
Of this guy telling these really elaborate and involved stories. He's dreaming and he's narrating them, basically. He's in a conversation with someone, or he's hosting something. He's telling some kind of story. It's very detailed, and you can get a real sense of the world that he's in. And it's usually pretty terrifying. Like it's a lot of stressful situations he's in. So yeah, that's what that is.
Dean McGregor. That's so bizarre.
Yeah, it's
and
weird.
Not what I was expecting at all. Are you pretty like, do you get into that whole just subconscious and dream states? I think was it Becoming a Gunship, the chorus? Was that the one that you dreamed? I remember.
Yes,
right?
Yes. I dreamed that line. When it was dark, I was a question mark. I get a lot of inspiration from dreams. I get a lot.
Do you sort of actively pursue that? Like, are you sort of fascinated by, I don't know, that sort of thing?
I honor it. Yeah, I will wake up and write dreams down all the time. A lot of story ideas that I have come from dreams. And I try to honor that that inspiration, because it's a great, it's unfiltered, you know, it's coming. Mm. It's coming through you in a pretty pure, unfiltered way. So I think it's a great place to, it's a great source to draw
from.
Yeah,
yeah. Because I get pretty into that as well. And I think it's real interesting. Like, you'll have a dream and you'll sort of, it fades so quickly as you wake up. Like, there's all these like images and things, and they don't quite connect together. And the minute that you try to tell someone and bore them, usually, or like write it down, and you have to actually put it together in sentences that make sense, and it feels like with every new word you write, something is ruined, something new is lost, like I guess that's the trick, is putting it, if you want to filter it into a creative thing, is having that almost, I guess, discipline to sort of keep whatever the spark of what's still interesting to you as you're awake.
Yeah, exactly. That's the game. The other
spoken word thingy that I wanted to ask you about was Oscar the Demon at the beginning of Volcanoes.
Yes, that's from this American call-in show called Coast to Coast that deals with supernatural and conspiracy theory stuff. I think in recent years it's just gone more neoconservative or something. It has less to do with fun, weird kind of aliens and just reptilian shapeshifters, just a little lighter stuff. And I was driving home one night in LA when we were still in LA working on the first Islands record, and just was listening to the show because I liked the show, and this demon just called in. He was like, I'm a demon. And that was straight up, that was what that was, and that's just the jumping off point for the
right
that song.
That line, I'm a demon, like, which just comes across as a by the way sort of, like,
it's pretty casual.
It's always tickled me. And I think it's like, there's a Tim and Eric sketch where it's Will Forte doing like nightmare stuff, and just this, you know, the cutaways that they just do real abrupt, and just cuts away from some awful screaming to just Will Forte just barreling the camera. I'm a demon, and to me, it's just always been this like,
That's
almost
funny.
Like an accidental reference.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of just slipped in there.
Yeah.
Like it's it's not the most unusual thing in the history of the world.
Exactly. Yeah. And speaking of Tim and Eric, like I wanted to talk to you about comedy and about film, because I know that you studied film.
Yes.
And you've sort of flirted with it, you know, along the way. And you've recently done a short film called That Dog.
Correct.
Which I've managed to watch. And I got a very, the comedy. Did you see The Comedy?
Yes, I did.
Tim Heidecker.
Yeah.
Were you influenced or inspired by that at all? Or is it just like...
not directly, but I did like that movie. Especially what I liked about it was Tim's performance. And that definitely made me think. I mean, I know Tim and Michael socially, so I had an idea of their sensibility and their dry kind of humor. So I definitely wrote it with those guys in mind, and I was really lucky that they both partook. And yeah, Tim is just such a good dramatic actor that, you know, there's always something kind of funny about it, but he's a really natural actor.
He's really got down the sort of thing of being able to play like a deeply unlikable person.
Yes, he's really good at that. It's all an act.
Yeah, I was wondering about how, like, because I feel like I remember you talking about how the reason that you went for music even after studying film is that it just felt more accessible, like more immediate. You could just go and play a song. Meanwhile, to set up and make a movie, there's all these other moving parts and you sort of can't do it on your own sort of thing.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, you're inside my brain.
I'm sorry. I'm trying really hard not. I remember about 10 years ago or something, I heard a fan interview Ed O'Brien from Radiohead. And I remember going, this guy sounds way too fucking intense. And I'm trying not to be that guy.
No, you're not intense. It's just, it's amazing. Your level of recall for everything I said. It feels like you're in my brain right now.
I'm just like a very big fan.
Oh, cool. Well, thanks.
It's like I did do some like deliberate research leading up to this, like checking out Reefer and stuff. But most of this just comes from, for the last like 10 years or so, I've pretty much exclusively listened to your music and Radiohead. And
oh, wow.
Like,
well, thank you.
Yeah, like I don't know if I'd still be making music. I mean, not that that really means anything to you necessarily because you don't know my music, but like I don't know if I would be if I hadn't discovered yours.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah. So, no, I that means a lot. What's your band called?
I've been in a few. I guess the main one for most of this time has been called Great North. It's sort of like a folk sort of band, which we actually, I think, I can't remember now, but I feel like we would have shared a bill with Tiny Ruins, who I know that you're
been
a bit of a fan of.
Awesome.
So it felt kind of as with any New Zealander, like we get this thing of whenever we hear someone who's not from New Zealand like mention a New Zealand thing, like our ears prick up as though it's someone mentioning our name. So when I heard that in an interview, it's like, ooh.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Yeah, that's the similar in Canada too, living, you know, so close to America that when you get name checked, when you hear a Canadian name checked in America, it does feel, there's something satisfying, you know, there's some kind of communal, you know, Canada and New Zealand, I think, are probably pretty equivalent.
Yeah.
To their relationships to the neighboring countries and stuff. Yeah.
There are a lot of comparisons that people make.
Yeah.
So with That Dog, what was it like going from doing music all the time to suddenly like doing this movie? And I guess because also you directed a couple of music videos recently.
I did. Only one is out right now. The other one's coming out in July.
The other one's a one shot, right?
Yes, correct.
I'm excited to see that.
Cool, yeah. I think it's out at the end of July.
Did it work out well?
I think so, yeah. I mean, we did a couple takes, and we got, yeah, I think we got what we wanted. It's pretty simple, you know, but it's, it was the easiest way to do two videos in one day, I think. Sure. So.
Yeah, they sounded pretty hectic.
Yeah.
Tim Heidecker did a one-shot video for, I think it was for Work at Home. Have you seen that?
Yes, it's a great video, too.
Oh, so beautiful.
Yeah, it's really fantastic. That video is far superior.
Oh, okay. I'll keep my expectations.
Yeah, keep it low.
All right.
Yeah.
What was it like? Like, do you find it intimidating going on to a set, like the amount of people involved and equipment and things?
The transition from music to directing, what very little directing I've done.
Yeah.
It's pretty, you know, being the leader of a band and it's pretty similar to being a director on set. There's a lot of little micromanaging things that need to happen and decisions that need to be made and a lot of people to oversee and help direct and work with and get everyone on the same page. So it was a pretty natural transition, actually. It felt very comfortable in that role.
Should we expect to see more of those? Because I also saw that there was at the end, I always forget how to pronounce it, but like the Manque or whatever.
Oh yeah, Manque.
Manque movies?
Yeah, so yeah, yeah.
Does franchise. That mean that we'll see more from you?
Yeah. That's the idea, yeah. There's a couple more things I'm doing in the works and in pre-production, but they're sort of guaranteed that they'll be made. They're on the docket, so yeah, there'll be a couple more short things that I'm trying to do just to kind of work that out, get a better sense of how to direct and make stuff, and then, you know, if I'm lucky, expand to longer form things.
Cool, that's exciting. And all that, you're working with Jash for all that?
For one of the things that's coming up, yeah. Yeah, but it's still, you know, we're still sorting out casting and all that. So
sure.
A bit of a ways off. But.
What does it look like on the ground, like working with Jash? Like, because all I know really about Jash is it's like people from vaguely the Tim and Eric world sort of working together to make stuff.
Yeah, I don't work with those guys. You know, the creative heads. They're more remote. They do their projects through the thing, and they're kind of the guardians of the creativity control, the creative control that Jash allows. But you know, I work day to day with a producer there, Daniel Kellison, and a couple of other people that are more, you know, day to day business stuff.
Right. There were two little things in the movie that I thought were cool little references or cool little images. One was the L. Ron Hubbard book at the beginning.
You Death spotted Place. That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was there, like, I don't know, some idea that you, or some backstory or something that you were hinting at, or
just maybe that this woman who's clearly not from America, maybe he was in LA and was, you know, just lost and looking for answers. Like most times people in Scientology, they ended up there because they're sort of lost and adrift and looking for someone to guide them. And so it just seemed like something maybe her character would read.
Right.
Yeah. Ooh. It was a book that I had. I picked it up because it's like an insane look. It's one of his weird sci-fi books, so it's just like looks totally insane. I thought it was funny. Yeah, it's like kind of outrageous, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Death Quest is such a good name, and also the food. Yes, poster.
Oh yeah,
I love that.
Thanks. Well, yeah, my friend Dean Fleischer Camp made a series of posters like that. All really awesome, like vague. Generic kind of what you'd see in the backgrounds of movies of people who could like afford these to license these like kind of generic posters. So he made a series like sort of satirizing that.
Oh, cool.
And he's an amazing director who made like Marcel the Shell, which is like,
oh,
a big
of course.
YouTube. Yes. And he's a really talented filmmaker. So
yeah.
Yeah, and he's a friend, so I put those in there.
Ah, choice. Yeah. All right. I wanted to ask you about your guitar, your Airline Mep guitar. So it's a reissue of a vintage.
Yeah, and the original is fiberglass, so it doesn't really sound like the original ones. I mean, it sounds much better. But...
Yeah, I can imagine. Right. I think it's the only guitar that I've seen you use. Do you use other guitars ever?
Like in the studio? Yeah, in the studio, I try to, but mine always sounds better. Like I just know it, and I can get the specific tone that I want out of it. So, there's some times when I'll use like a Strat or something to get a specific tone or sound. Mm. But for the most part, my guitar is just what I like and what sounds good. And it is weird. I mean, I've been using it for 8 years now, and really I don't use really anything else. But yeah.
Did you do like research on it, or is it sort of a happy accident that you found like the perfect guitar?
It was kind of a happy accident. Yeah. A friend, I was opening for a friend's band, and my guitar snapped in half. I had an SG.
All right.
And the necks are very fragile, and I dropped it or threw it. I did something kind of dramatic, and it snapped in half. And my friend in the headlining band that we were opening for was kind enough to lend me, I think permanently, he just gave me his guitar, which was a similar, it was made by the same company, and they sponsored him, so they had given it to him anyway. So he gave it to me, and I liked it, and then I think I just wanted another one, or that one, I don't know where that one went, but I ended up contacting the company and getting like, you know, an artist discount on a guitar, and I've just been using that ever since. Definitely got my money's worth.
yeah, for sure. It's seems to have done you well.
Yeah.
You seem to have a few like literary influences. It seems that you read a lot of books in your songs. Like Witch Window was inspired by the Book of Strange New Things. Is that right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I forgot that. Yeah.
Right. Huh? Do you sort of just get into an idea kind of heavily and like write a thing, and then it doesn't necessarily stick with you? It's just like what you're into at the time.
I guess so. Yeah, I'd forgotten that. But, you know, I'm just pulling ideas and inspiration from as many places as I can. It's not there's no exclusive schematic. I just if I see something that grabs me and I want to like interpret it or use it as a jumping off point for a song or any kind of inspiration, you know, I just try to, be open.
Yeah. I guess, I remember I heard you say that, I think maybe even on the same day that I like heard a Sufjan Stevens interview, and he talked about like, he'll treat writing a song as almost doing like a research project on a certain thing.
Uh-huh.
And
right.
I think just the two things sort of clicked together in my brain. I just thought, I wonder if Nick does that.
Yeah, I guess there's an element of that, yeah.
I didn't really have a follow-up question to that. I just found it...
Observation.
I think just anytime someone writes something that's not, I don't know, just kind of your sort of standard, and not standard bad, but standard like a love song or a breakup song or something, like anytime there's some sort of cerebral or academic inspiration or anything at all, I find it a bit interesting, I guess, because it's slightly more removed from the person writing it. I don't know what I'm talking about.
I don't know what I'm writing about. Just kind of it's all sort of subconscious.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
just before we go on to I don't want to keep you like forever, there's a couple of things that I like try to ask everyone who I get on. Maynard Keenan from Tool once said in an interview that he talked about how he reckons it would be hard to be like a straight up materialist, like I guess just sort of stereotypical kind of atheist, like everything that we see is everything that there is, and not believe in some kind of magic or higher power or something, and still be like creative. Do you have like, I don't know, like an echo of a voice or like an idea or something that sort of resonates with you, that sort of motivates you to write about life and things?
I don't know. I don't like to think about it too much because I feel like you can kind of psych yourself out. And if there is some kind of mystical muse, I wouldn't really want to know too much about it because I think it might get freaked out and not keep coming out. But yeah, I try to just let it happen, you know. And when I write, I just try to. The last thing I want to do is think about what I'm doing. I just want to kind of be in it. And when I come out of it, of that mode, then I can kind of be more critical and try to figure it out. But when it's happening, I'm not really aware of much. Maybe sure. It's. Yeah, I mean. I don't really believe in anything like that, but
yeah.
But I tend to be sort of superstitious, so you know, there's always a possibility that there's some kind of guidance, but I don't have any idea one way or the other.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. So just before we move on to the second section, the sort of crossover question that I like to ask is a little section that I like to call Name Drop It Like It's Hot.
Name drop it like it's hot. Name drop it like it's hot.
We let go, we shirk all the, like, that it's kind of a faux pas to sort of name drop. What's your best name dropping story?
I don't know. Like, I saw Jack Nicholson the other night, a few
That's
months
cool.
ago. Yeah, he was at a restaurant, walked into the restaurant with his kids. That was kind of crazy. But, I mean, it's not like I had a personal – it's not really a name drop because I just saw him. I was like a, it was like a safari. He was like the lion, the pride, the head of the lion, you know, pack was
yeah.
seeing him in the celebrity safari. But, I don't know if I have a decent Dude from Entourage was backstage at an Island show once.
Oh, yeah.
Or no, Mr. Heavenly show. That was really weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, does that kind of thing happen in LA quite a bit? Like just being...
Well, that was in New York. But,
oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think someone said Benedict Cumberbatch was at an Island show once. He was like standing in front of them and they couldn't see. But I'm oblivious to all that stuff. Like I don't see, I'm not aware of what's happening or, you know.
yeah, not really interested.
Yeah, but I guess LA, you know, there's a lot of notable people in LA and they tend to
live their lives.
They like to go out to shows and stuff, so you can see them around. Yeah.
Right. So in the second section, I kind of like to go from the like the name of the podcast is Prosumer. So I like to go from like the professional side, like so you as a musician, etc., to you as a consumer. So just like find out what you're into. I'll start with We're about a similar age, so I just thought I'd compare notes on albums that we enjoyed listening to growing up.
Okay.
So I'll just throw some albums at you, and you let me know if you had a connection with them.
Okay.
Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness by Smashing Pumpkins.
Yeah, I remember picking that up on CD, double CD.
Double CD.
That was, what, 95 or 96?
Yeah, 95, yeah, I think.
95. Yeah, I had a good time with that record. I was a fan of that band. First concert I ever saw was Lollapalooza 94, and they headlined Smashing Pumpkins, and I was a fan. I was a fan of that band, a fan of that record.
Did you drop off the Smashing Pumpkins thing at any point?
I did, probably after that record, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I think by the time Adore came out or whatever it was called.
Yeah, Adore.
I was out the door on that band.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right, Moby Play.
Nine.
No.
But I see him everywhere in LA.
Oh,
he owns a vegan restaurant. That's
right, because you're vegan,
good.
Aren't you?
I'm a vegetarian. But he's got a restaurant that's pretty decent, and he's always eating in there. I think he's like the mascot. He's like supposed to be in there. But
right.
No, I never listened to that record. And, you know, it was every song was licensed to a commercial, famously. And, And so I associate that song with like a car commercial or something. That's my association with that.
Right, right. I remember it for me being like, I would have been maybe 12 or 13 when it came out. And I remember it was the first album that I was kind of aware of, like, oh, everyone has this album. I should have this album kind of thing.
Okay.
Just to like be a part of the culture around me.
Sure. Yeah, you want to be invited to the party.
Yeah, and so I got it, and I was, and I recognized all the different commercials. so I was fine, I was in. All right.
Right,
this one's very unlikely, but Aqua Aquarium?
No, I mean, I remember that single Barbie Girl, but I hated it with every fiber of my being.
Yeah, I think that might be that, like, the couple years age difference between us. I think I was about 11 when it came out, and weirdly, okay. I was listening to that. I remember going on a trip with my family somewhere, and I had two cassette tapes that I had on heavy rotation. One was Aqua Aquarium, and the other one was Bjork Post.
Wow.
Did you get
pretty
into
different
Bjork?
Yeah, I did. I mean, not really, but definitely always appreciated her music. Always, have, but I wasn't big into that record, but
right,
definitely would pick that one over over Aqua.
Yeah, there's only one of those two albums I will still listen to.
Right.
Yeah, Echo was kind of the wild card in there.
Yeah.
Another album that I wondered if you had listened to or had any thoughts on or affinity with was, like, with you, you released two albums at once, which was hard enough for me to sort of, like, as I said, like, I'm a slow listener, and it's taken me a long time to process them and kind of get through them, which has been great. But then, like, in the same week, Radiohead put out A Moon-Shaped Pool, which I have also been obsessing over. Have you had time, or are you into Radiohead?
I don't pay too close attention to Radiohead, but, no, they're cool. I haven't heard that record yet, but I'll get to it and check it out. There's definitely songs that there's I quite like, so
yeah, cool. All right, to move away from music, based solely on how prolific you are with, like, putting stuff out, I'm going to guess the answer here is no, but are you or were you into video gaming at all?
Video games?
Yeah.
As a young kid, like, I had a Sega Genesis and a Nintendo before that, so that was my extent. I sort of tapered off when I was about 14, but
right.
From like 7 to 14, it was, I was big into Super Mario Brothers and Toe Jam and Earl and
that was
shit
a
like
weird
that.
One.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah, I remember just not getting what I was meant to do in that one.
Yeah, I don't know if I remember what I did, but
yeah,
it was fun. It looked good.
Yeah. Do you like kill time on tour, like playing like Candy Crush or something on your cell phone?
No, I don't have the.
It's just not in you.
It's not in me. No, I it feels like just too great a waste of time to play any kind of video games. And in our van, we had a TV with an Xbox, but we never once turned it on. No, it's just it's not really in the nature of our band.
Right.
Game.
Okay. That's I guess that's how you're able to put out so much good stuff.
I guess so.
Not wasting too much time on dumb stuff. I don't want to keep you for ages, so we'll just do the final three.
Final three.
This is to sum you up as a human, as a consumer, so think carefully. Final three. Question the first. Tom Hanks or Tom Cruise?
Oh, Tom Hanks.
Yeah?
Yeah. The Burbs, man.
Yeah.
That shit is great.
That terrified me as a child.
Yeah, me too.
And then I watched it again, like, maybe even just, like, last year. It holds up. Good movie.
Yeah, I'd like to see it again. He just seems like a nice guy, you know?
Yeah.
He seems like a real down-to-earth dude, so go with him.
Man. I wish he was my dad. Today's my dad's 60th birthday, so I shouldn't say things like that.
Oh, yeah, you shouldn't.
Yeah.
You should call him after this.
I think I will. I'm going around to his house for afternoon tea.
Nice.
No, perfect. I like my dad. I you know, but it's Tom Hanks. Anyway.
Yeah.
Favorite Pokemon?
Don't know. I know nothing about Pokemon other than the yellow little creature. So I guess the yellow guy.
All right, Pikachu.
Yeah.
You're a Pikachu man. All right, speaking of
Well, I honestly don't. I don't want to pledge allegiance to Pikachu because I don't know anything about him or her or what or it or whatever it is. I've seen that image. I don't know if that qualifies as my favorite.
It has to.
Okay. All right.
It's part of the rules.
It's like the Mickey Mouse of Disney characters, though. It's kind of the obvious one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Who's your favorite Disney character?
I don't know.
You're going to say Mickey Mouse, aren't you?
No. I don't... No, Mickey Mouse is annoying. I don't know if I have one. They're all annoying.
What about the whale from Pinocchio? I really like that.
Sure.
As a kid.
Yeah, let's go with the
I know
whale.
Why I'm giving you one. Like, that's...
Yeah.
That's not
no,
really
I'll take care. That. Okay. No, I'll take that.
Really? All right.
Yeah.
Okay, and speaking of yellow characters, favorite Simpsons episode?
I don't know. I mean, some of those early ones were pretty awesome. I was definitely watching those as a kid.
Yeah.
In like the fourth grade. That was some pivotal stuff. I like the one where he does peyote in the desert.
Oh, yeah. With the Johnny Cash fox.
Yeah.
Peyote.
Yeah. It looks pretty cool.
Yeah.
The animation was really nice.
It was very trippy.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I love that one. That was in season 8, which is the best season. If you ever feel like going back and like marathoning a good few Simpsons episodes, just go straight to season 8.
Oh yeah? What year? Yeah. Was that like 96 or something?
Yeah, I guess it would have been about then, maybe a little bit later. But
anyway,
all the best ones. It's got Frank Grimes. It's got all sorts. Anyway.
All
right. That's it. I had a lot of questions, but I didn't want to waste your whole day. And I didn't want to be that intense Ed O'Brien interviewer. So,
no, you did wonderfully. Yeah, that was great. Thank you. That you did great. This was good.
Thanks so much. This has been a bloody honor, Nick. I genuinely didn't actually expect you to respond when I first said, like, hey, do you want to do this? So the fact that you did and that we're talking now is...
it was a real treat. You I like the cut of your jib, so keep it up. Don't blow it.
All right. Okay. I'll be cool.
Cool.
Yeah. Cheers. Looking forward to the next thing that you do.
All right. Thanks, man. Thanks for listening. Call your dad.
All right. I will. I'll get over there right away.
All right. Oh, yeah. Go see him.
Okay. Cheers, Nick.
All right. Bye, man.
That's the end. I hope you're feeling fat and sassy. I'm feeling still got that migraine creeping in. So I'll go take care of that. You go take care of your needs. I'll go take care of mine.